Usually, when we think about unbreakable military encryption, we picture these, these massive gleaming metal machines.
Right, yeah, like the Enigma machine.
Exactly. Room-sized computers humming with electricity, or, I don't know, complex steel rotors built in these secret government labs with millions of dollars of engineering behind
Oh,
them.
for sure. We completely expect the entire weight of a nation's defense budget, right?
Yeah.
Like teams of mathematicians and the strictest security protocols imaginable.
Right, but then you step into the world of a man named John F. Byrne, and suddenly that multi-million-dollar lab is, well, it's replaced by a kitchen table.
It really is.
Because today, for this deep dive, we are looking at an encryption machine made entirely out of cardboard and wood.
Which is just wild to even think about.
It's insane. So, welcome to today's deep dive. We're going on a mission, just you and us, to unravel a 90-year mystery.
A very long, very frustrating mystery.
We are exploring the Chaosopher. It's this allegedly unbreakable encryption machine invented way back in 1918 that completely baffled the greatest cryptographic minds of the 20th century. And it was kept a closely guarded secret for nearly 100 years.
And to guide us through this, we are pulling our insights today from a truly comprehensive 2011 academic paper.
Yeah, it's a great story.
It's called John F. Byrne's Chaosopher Revealed, an Historical and Technical Appraisal, and it's written by Moshe Rubin.
And the tension here is just delicious. You have this amateur inventor wielding literally nothing but cardboard and wood, trying to outfox the entire military intelligence apparatus.
Yeah.
So to understand how a cipher could remain a mystery for 90 years, we first have to understand the completely unlikely background of the man who invented it. Who exactly is building cardboard ciphers in 1918? Because, I mean, I am picturing a disgruntled engineer or some rogue mechanic.
You'd think so, right? But not even close. John F. Byrne was born in Dublin, Ireland in 1880, and his background is just fascinatingly eclectic.
Eclectic how?
Well, he wasn't an engineer at all. He was actually a very strong chess player. He won numerous tournaments in Dublin, and he was deeply knowledgeable about philosophy.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, specifically the writings of Spinoza.
A chess player and a philosopher. That's a very different kind of analytical mind.
Exactly. It's a literary and strategic mind. He studied at Belvedere College and University College in Dublin, where he became an intimate friend of the legendary author James Joyce.
Wait, James Joyce?
Yeah.
Like Ulysses James Joyce?
The very same. They were incredibly close. In fact, Joyce actually based the character named Cranley in his famous novel, A Portrait of the Artist, as a young man directly on Byrne.
Wait, really? So he's a literal character in classic literature.
He is. And it goes further than that. Joyce even used Byrne's real-life address, 7 Eccles Street in Dublin, as the home of Leopold and Molly Bloom.
No way.
Yeah, the main characters in Joyce's masterpiece, Ulysses, that was Byrne's actual house.
Okay, so you have this highly intellectual, culturally connected figure hanging out with literary giants. How does a guy like that end up building a military-grade cryptography machine?
Well, he eventually leaves Ireland for the United States in 1910. He moves to New York and works as a journalist.
Okay, still not an engineer.
Right. He becomes an editorial writer and a financial editor, writing for the Daily News Record, the New York Times, and the Wall Street Journal. He has virtually no background in cryptography, none.
Just zero experience.
Aside from like a vague story about smuggling one secret cipher transcript into London for Irish rebels once, he is a total outsider. Yet in 1918, he conceives the concept of the Chaosopher entirely in his head.
In his head.
Yes, he doesn't even draft the actual blueprints until 1919, and that was only after a patent attorney advised him that, hey, you probably should write this down.
That is just, it feels so modern in a way. It's like a brilliant but completely rogue indie software developer today, trying to sell a homemade operating system directly to the Pentagon.
That's a perfect comparison.
They have absolutely no formal credentials, just walking into the front door saying, "Look, I built this in my garage and it's better than anything you have."
What's fascinating here is that despite his complete amateur status, Byrne's very first foray into cryptography produced a cipher vastly more sophisticated and secure than most professional inventors of his time.
So it wasn't just some gimmick.
Yeah, it wasn't
Well,
a toy. It was a
yeah.
serious, deeply complex system.
But because Byrne had this incredible machine and absolutely zero military standing, his attempts to pitch his invention to the U.S. government hit a massive bureaucratic wall, which, sparks this decades-long standoff.
Yeah, massive wall.
Okay, let's unpack this. If you were an outsider in the 1920s, How do you even get a meeting with the military to show them your cardboard box?
It requires relentless pitching. I mean, he just wouldn't give up. In 1920, he tries the State Department.
And how did that go?
They return his papers, basically stating they don't feel equipped to evaluate it. But Byrne doesn't stop. In 1921, he manages to contact Colonel Parker Hitt.
Who is that?
Colonel Hitt is a massive figure in this space. He literally authored the seminal treatise called The Manual for the Solution of Military Ciphers.
Oh, wow. So that is the exact guy you want looking at your invention.
And Hitt actually gives the chaos cipher a glowing appraisal. In a letter to Byrne, Hitt calls the principle of the machine a most ingenious and effective device.
That's huge validation.
It is. He admits he hasn't been able to break the sample codes and tells Byrne he could safely exploit it commercially.
I am sensing a massive however coming here. Because if the author of the military cipher manual says it's brilliant, why didn't the military adopt it immediately?
Because of the environment in which military codes are actually used, Hitt pointed out a fatal flaw in the machine's design regarding telegraphic transmission.
Ah, right. The 1920s.
Exactly. Messages were sent over telegraph or early radio. Static happens. Letters get dropped. In a normal cipher, if a letter drops, you might lose a word, but the rest of the message is fine.
You can still read it.
Right. But because of how the chaosopher physically changed its own internal alphabet with every single keystroke, if a receiving telegraph operator missed just one letter.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Their machine would instantly fall permanently out of sync with the sender's machine. The entire rest of the message would turn into absolute garbage.
Oh, wow. So in a chaotic battlefield environment, the machine is completely useless. It demands perfect transmission.
Hitt made that very clear. But here's the funny part. When Byrne later quoted Hitt's letter to promote the chaosopher, he completely edited out those warnings.
He just cropped them out.
Yep. He only quoted the praise.
Classic marketing spin. Hide the flaws, blast the positive reviews. But, I mean, it gets him in the door, doesn't it?
It does. In 1922, Hitt introduces Byrne to Major Frank Moorman and William F. Friedman. Now, William Friedman is essentially the godfather of American cryptanalysis.
A true heavy hitter.
Exactly. He would go on to be the head cryptanalyst for the U.S. Signal Corps. So Byrne leaves a rudimentary model of the chaosopher with them, but it gets inadvertently damaged in transit when they return it.
Ouch.
Yeah, Friedman apologizes profusely, but he also notes the model was very difficult to operate and produce consistent errors.
So Byrne takes his broken cardboard model and just goes home. What happens next?
Decades pass. Literally decades. He tries the Navy in 1937, which goes nowhere. Then in 1942, 20 years after their first meeting, Byrne approaches William Friedman again.
20 years later.
And this is where the standoff solidifies into a massive clash of egos. Friedman practically begs Byrne to just follow standard scientific protocol.
Because the military had rules for this, right?
Exactly. The military had established strict procedures for submitting ciphers, specifically a protocol called Enclosure B.
What does Enclosure B require?
It required inventors to submit a detailed statement of their cryptographic method and, crucially, sets of at least 50-word plaintext messages alongside their corresponding ciphertexts.
So they needed the key and the map?
They needed to see the before and after to understand the mechanism. They needed to see exactly how the machine turned plain English into scrambled code.
Let me guess. The chess player didn't want to show his moves.
Byrne stubbornly refuses. He sends this blunt reply demanding Friedman just declare the cipher unbreakable based on the scrambled text alone.
Just blind faith.
Yeah. He literally asks Friedman, "Do you deny my assertion that this cipher document as it stands is indecipherable?"
I am trying to put myself in Byrne's shoes here. He built this thing, he knows it's brilliant, and he is probably terrified someone is going to steal his intellectual property. Was the military just being stubbornly closed-minded and bureaucratic, or was Byrne being totally unreasonable?
The military was entirely justified here. You have to remember, Friedman and his team had just spent years breaking the Japanese per PLE machine.
Right, they were fighting a world war.
They knew the reality of modern warfare. A cryptographic system simply cannot be verified as secure by staring at a single scrambled message. That is not how real-world security works.
You need to see the guts of it.
You need massive volume, and you need to stress test the mechanism itself to find the structural weaknesses. Byrne fundamentally misunderstood the science of cryptanalysis.
And he didn't just alienate Friedman, right? Other experts brushed him off, too.
Oh, yeah. Fast forward to 1958. Byrne reaches out to Herbert O. Yardley, another legendary codebreaker. Yardley had previously written an article about a time he dismissed a submitted message as a total fraud because its letter frequencies were perfectly flat.
What does that mean, perfectly flat?
Well, in normal English, letters appear at different rates. The letter E shows up all the time, while Z is really rare.
Like in Scrabble.
Exactly like Scrabble. A flat frequency means every single letter in the alphabet appears exactly as often as every other letter in the coded message.
Oh.
Yardley thought a flat frequency looked like someone just closing their eyes and randomly mashing a typewriter to fake a code, because real codes usually leave some sort of statistical footprint.
And Byrne took offense to that because his machine produced a perfectly flat frequency.
Exactly. Byrne demanded Yardley admit that a perfectly flat cipher wasn't necessarily a fraud. Yardley essentially just ignored him. But Yardley and Friedman were right to be skeptical. You cannot evaluate a black box without looking inside.
So what does this all mean? He couldn't get the military to play his game. They demand testing. He demands blind faith. So, utterly frustrated by decades of rejections, he decides to pull a truly wild move.
A huge pivot.
He bypasses the government entirely and takes his unbreakable machine directly to the public.
It is a massive pivot. In 1953, he publishes his autobiography. It is called Silent Years, an autobiography with memoirs of James Joyce and our Ireland.
Imagine you are a fan of James Joyce. You buy this literary memoir. You're reading all these stories about Byrne's childhood, his deep friendship with Joyce, his thoughts on the gold standard.
There is even a science fiction story in there.
Right. But Byrne explicitly states in the book that his primary reason for writing and publishing Silent Years wasn't the literary history at all. His overriding purpose was to put the chaos cipher on the public record.
He wrote an entire memoir just to drop a crypto puzzle at the end of it.
Which is incredible. Chapter 21 of the book is dedicated entirely to his cipher. And in it, he presents the ultimate challenge to the world. He publishes 4 incredible exhibits of cipher text.
And we are talking massive amounts of text here. Exhibit 1 alone has over 13,000 characters. It includes encryptions of the Declaration of Independence and the Gettysburg Address.
That's a lot of data to give the public.
Plus, he throws in a 262-character entirely unsolved challenge. He even encrypts a speech by General Douglas MacArthur in Exhibit 4.
Why MacArthur?
Well, the MacArthur speech was unique because the plain English text he provided was actually shorter than the ciphertext, forcing the solver to figure out how they mapped to each other. He also left full instructions for an initiate hidden within that specific ciphertext.
Oh, that's so clever.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, this was Byrne's put your money where your mouth is moment. He was so confident that his machine was indecipherable that he laid it bare for anyone in the world to try and crack.
Come and get it.
Exactly. And by publishing those ciphertexts, he accidentally created a holy grail for amateur code breakers. It became an enduring mystery that would outlast him. He died in 1960, but the puzzle he printed in Silent Years lived on.
So with the puzzle now out in the wild, the dismissive military is totally out of the picture. The baton passes to a highly dedicated group of civilian code breakers, specifically members of the American Cryptogram Association, or the ACA.
A very passionate group.
If you were an amateur codebreaker opening this book in the 1960s or 70s, you became obsessed.
Obsessed is the exact word. For decades, nobody made any headway. And just to be clear, there were no government agencies secretly working on it.
Really? Not even the NSA?
No. Freedom of Information Act requests have never turned up any evidence that the NSA or the British GCHQ ever spent a single minute looking at the chaosifer. It was purely a grassroots civilian pursuit.
But then we get to the late 1970s. And an ACA researcher named Greg Mellon makes a breakthrough. Not a full crack of the code, but a serious crack in the armor.
Yeah, Mellon writes a landmark paper after studying that massive 13,000-character Exhibit 1 intensely. He identifies a unique, highly specific quirk in how the chaosifer scrambles text.
What did he find?
He notices that whenever there were doubled letters in the plain English, like the double L and the word A-all-L or the double O and good, they never resulted in doubled letters in the scrambled code.
Meaning, if you type LL into the machine, it would never come out as XX or BB.
Right.
It would always come out as 2 completely different letters, like XQ.
Exactly. In cryptography, this phenomenon is called no hits at distance 1. And the reason this was such a massive discovery is statistical probability.
Because true randomness should have doubles.
Yes. If you flip a coin enough times, eventually you will get heads twice in a row. True randomness creates clusters. In a truly random scramble of 13,000 characters, you would mathematically expect to see about 20 to 25 double letters in the ciphertext just by pure chance.
But in Byrne's cipher?
There were absolutely 0.
Because it wasn't random. This proves Yardley's flat frequency theory wrong.
Mm.
It wasn't just a guy closing his eyes and randomly mashing a typewriter.
Right. It proved that a forced mechanical process was driving the encryption. The internal components of the cipher must have been physically changing state after every single letter was pressed.
He couldn't sit still.
Exactly. The machine physically could not sit still, which meant hitting the same letter twice in a row forced the gears into a new alignment before the second letter could even print.
That discovery gets the amateur community completely fired up. Throughout the 1980s, people are analyzing it, trying to build mathematical models that fit this no-hits rule.
It was a renaissance for the chaosopher.
And then, fast forward to 1990, two ACA members, Lou Crew and Cypher Devers, actually managed to track down John F. Burns' son. His name is also John, and he's living up in Vermont.
And after years of resisting, the son finally agrees to disclose the inner workings of the chaosopher to Crew and Devers.
They finally get to see it.
They get to see the actual drawings. They get to hold the components of the rudimentary model.
Here's where it gets really interesting.
Hmm.
Crew and Devers write a big turning point paper for the journal Cryptologia in 1990. They announce to the world that they have seen the machine. They know exactly how it works.
Yep. A huge announcement.
But they refused to publish the algorithm.
They held it back. Instead of revealing the secret to the world, they decided to publish more ciphertext challenges.
Which is just so perfectly dramatic.
They released what became known as Exhibit 5, three more messages, about 25 words each, encrypted with the chaosopher. They wanted to see if anyone else could crack it using this new data, effectively keeping Burns' mystery alive for another two decades.
They were basically testing to see if the algorithm had commercial value for modern computer security. If no one in the cryptographic community could crack the new exhibits, maybe Burns' cardboard box really was as unbreakable as he claimed.
And nobody did crack them. The research languished until 2009. That brings us to the final countdown. The son, John, passed away in 2008. Yeah, but the author of our source paper today, Moshe Rubin, tracked down John's widow, Patricia Byrne. Pat generously decided to donate the entire chaosopher collection, all the original papers, the cardboard and wood machine components, the decades of correspondence to the National Cryptologic Museum in Maryland.
Which finally lifted the veil. In 2010, Moshe Rubin was able to publish the actual algorithm, ending 90 years of total secrecy.
The wait was over.
Researchers could finally look under the hood and see how this legendary machine actually worked, and the mechanism is wild to visualize.
It is a brilliant piece of physical mechanical logic. To understand it, we can look at the simplified alphabet strip model that Rubin describes in his paper.
Okay, paint a picture for us.
Imagine holding two physical wooden disks engaged together, like gears in a clock.
Okay, we have a left disk for the ciphertext and a right disk for the plaintext.
Exactly. Okay. Around the outer edge of each disk are 26 removable tabs, one for each letter of the alphabet. You can physically pull these tabs out and rearrange them.
Got it.
There are also two specific marker positions on the machine itself. The zenith, which is the 12 o'clock position, and the nadir, which is the 6 o'clock position.
So imagine you want to encrypt a letter. How do you do it?
It's a step-by-step process of what we call dynamic substitution. First, you rotate the right disk, the plaintext disk, until the letter you want to encrypt is at the zenith, the 12 o'clock position.
And because the disks are engaged like gears, rotating the right disk automatically forces the left disk to rotate as well.
Yes. Once your plain English letter is at the zenith on the right, you simply look over at what letter is sitting at the zenith on the left disk. That is your scrambled ciphertext letter.
Okay, so far that sounds exactly like a standard decoder ring you'd get in a cereal box. Line up A with G, write down G.
Ah, but here is the genius of the chaosopher. The very next step is physical permutation.
This is where it gets crazy.
After every single letter is encrypted, you physically extract specific letter tabs from the outer edges of both the left and right disks.
You actually pull them out of the wheel.
You pull them out, you shift all the remaining tabs down one spot to fill the empty hole, and then you reinsert the extracted tabs at the nadir, the 6 o'clock position.
It is constantly scrambling its own alphabet. Think of it like a combination lock on a safe. But every time you spin the dial, the numbers physically pop out of the metal and rearrange their order.
That's a great way to think of it.
If I press the letter A the first time, it might come out as C. But because the physical tabs have now been extracted, shifted, and replaced at the bottom of the disk, if the very next letter I type is also A, the internal landscape of the machine has completely changed.
Exactly.
That second A will come out as something completely different, maybe X.
And the physical rules for how the left disk permutes its tabs are slightly different from how the right disk permutes its tabs, creating this incredibly complex, constantly evolving internal state. You can see how an amateur inventor in 1918 would look at this and think he had created absolute magic.
Oh, absolutely.
But this raises an important question. Did this dynamic shifting actually make it perfectly random and unbreakable, like Byrne believed?
Right. Did his cardboard box actually beat the millions of dollars of military engineering?
Well, no, it didn't. The mechanical constraints, the physical rules of how those tabs had to be extracted and shifted down, left microscopic mathematical fingerprints.
Ah, the fingerprints.
Remember Greg Mellon noticing there were no double letters in the ciphertext?
The no-hits-at-distance one.
Exactly. Modern computer analysis showed that the Chaosopher also completely lacked repeated ciphertext letters at intervals of 2, 3, all the way up to 8.
Wow, really?
Yeah, because a physical block of 13 tabs was moving together as a single unit on the disk, it mathematically prevented those repeats from happening.
So it wasn't true randomness.
Yeah.
The physical mechanics cast a shadow over the math.
It produced a wave-like statistical pattern in the code, which proves that William Friedman and Herbert Yardley were absolutely right to be skeptical all those years ago.
They knew something had to be off.
Right. A perfect manual cipher is almost impossible because the physical mechanics required for a human being to operate it will always leave a mathematical shadow. The military's insistence on testing the volume of the ciphertext was the correct scientific approach.
Imagine how different this story would be if Byrne had just swallowed his pride and followed Enclosure B.
It would have changed cryptography history.
Which really brings this all back to you listening right now. The story of the Chaosopher is a profound lesson in the dangers of falling in love with your own unvetted creation. Byrne was undeniably brilliant. To invent that dynamic substitution method entirely in his head in 1918 is staggering.
It really is. But his brilliance was ultimately overshadowed by his stubbornness, his absolute refusal to collaborate, his refusal to follow standard testing protocols meant his invention was never utilized to help anyone.
Yeah, he spent his entire life fighting the experts instead of working with them.
He thought his cardboard and wood machine was magic, but he wouldn't let anyone look inside the box to verify it.
And that brings us to a final thought to leave you with today. If a purely mechanical, homemade cipher invented by a chess-playing journalist in 1918 could successfully hide its internal secrets from the world's greatest minds for 90 years.
Makes you wonder.
It really does. What other world-changing ideas or brilliant, unsolvable secrets are currently sitting in forgotten self-published memoirs or dusty attic boxes right now, just waiting for the exact right person to finally look at them?